Hello, and welcome to the Tulizane podcast, the Afro-optimistic space where we dare to learn by asking questions. I'm so excited to be back here. It is the first recording of 2024, so let me begin by saying Happy New Year to everybody, the audience, and my guests who you'll hear from in a bit. I'm excited to be here and very excited to have my guest today, because I think the topic is very optimistic, but also a bit of a sign about the kind of things that I'll be worrying about this year and in the near future. And I think that's for everybody. So this conversation is one I'm excited about because I have been a lover of nature and the environment. I'm the kind of person who loves noticing trees, fungus, mushrooms, bugs, anytime I'm walking in Karura or any other forest. And a few weeks ago, I was sitting at home and just enjoying the sound of the birds around, feeling very proud that I live somewhere that has such a variety of birds. And I realized that I actually don't know what they're called, except for the crow, the black kite. But there were the smaller ones that were a bit more mysterious. So I went on Google, being that this is a space where we verify information by actually doing a little bit of research. And that's why I landed on my guest's blog, which has a very interesting name. She'll tell us what that's all about. It's the kind of thing that I like because it's like nuanced. So the blog is called Nyika Silika. After getting lost binging on her posts, I knew that I would love to have a conversation with her on the podcast, just for her to share some of her knowledge with my curious listeners. Vicky, thank you, because the bird that piqued my interest was the African pied wagtail. And it's so cute. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you know more characteristics about it, because I was like, this bird looks intelligent from how it acted outside of my window. A little bit of an introduction. Victoria Wangoi is a self-defined believer in spreading information on environmental awareness, all that is good in Kenya's natural world. She's also a believer in speaking truth with no boundaries, a wildlife ecologist and storyteller, a writer and editor on her blog, Nyika Silika, which I mentioned. And she's also a digital media specialist and conservation communicator. Vicky has co-founded Biophilic Conversations, which is a platform that is geared towards the youth and conservation. Vicky is also a mom, Mothering Wild. I saw that on your blog and I was like, whoa, that's a good name. Mothering Wild. I hope it happens. Thank you for coming on the podcast, Vicky. Please let us know if I've captured everything you'd like our listeners to know, first of all, about you before we dive deeper in. Karibu.
Thank you so much, Teresa, for that introduction. It was actually very incredible. I don't think there's anything more I'd add about that, except for the podcast, the upcoming podcast. It's like a series. The whole series won't be called, the whole podcast won't be called Mothering Wild, but now it will just be a series. Well, just bring mothers in their conservation space to talk about their journey, their experience, what they've gone through, what they've experienced, because they're also men in conservation, so I don't want to lock them out of the conversation.
Being a woman myself, I just loved that concept of mothering wild. It just feels very how it should be. Last year, I was reading this book called Sapiens. The writer, I think his angle is normally just to remind us that we are not different from nature very much. Mm-hmm. We're not so different from elephants, for example. We're just communal animals at the end of the day. So mothering wild for me invokes just a mentality of how it should be. This is the people we were supposed to. We should be animals, mm-hmm. and love and interact and nurture our children, our environment, so that it lasts, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. I'd add to that, I'd say, I like to say we are part of nature. Mm-hmm. So regardless, we are not far away from it. It's who we are. And when we deviate away from it, we lose part of ourselves in this world.
yes, exactly. And that's why I'm so happy that we get to talk today. Something we'll touch on, climate anxiety, because I can't think of us being part of nature and not worry about what's happening to nature. The more involved human beings get with the environment, I don't know, that just gives me a little bit of a dread at the pit of my stomach feeling. And a kawoye, like, you remember how our parents used to tell us that they used to walk to school and slide in the mud and all? Like, I'm like, some of the stories of how I went to school will sound like this to future generations. How many Nairobi schools have a playground? And for me, breaks were the best part of school because I could go and disappear for a little bit down the field and do weird things. That's where I learned how to braid hair on the grass, right? Uh-huh. We used to sit and just corroga our own things. And you're in school, but it's funny because it's the new wave of experiential learning that they have in Silicon Valley, where they're bringing animals, and that's the private school that they're having. But we used to have that for free. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Almost for free because it was public education. I have some questions for you. I know you 100% are involved in communicating about conservation. You have your eye more tuned to what needs to be done or where the gaps are more than I can as a lay person. So I'm hoping that we can communicate a little bit more of that and especially talk about conservation. How can we all participate a little bit more in keeping a hold on this, what we love? Nairobi used to be called the city under the sun.
It still is the city under the sun.
Okay, tell me about that. How do you find we are now compared to when you were growing up, for example? Environmental-wise, is there things that you look at that make you feel like, whoa?
So I grew up in Nairobi. Okay. So most of my experience has been in Nairobi. And then I was lucky enough to at least go to a really amazing primary school where we had a playground, we had even a swimming pool, even if it was a public school. And Nairobi then and Nairobi now, most of the things that have changed is we have more roads, we have more buildings. Compared to back then, we also have more cars. But now what has reduced in Nairobi is there are no trucks. Because now, thank goodness for the Nairobi bypass, most of the southern bypass, most of the trucks deviated that side. So that's something people never realize. Yeah. But if you grew up in Nairobi, crossing the road, you'll always see a truck. Right now, you rarely see a truck. Maybe the ones which are have to offload inside the CBD. But these days, it's not something you see very often. And then also now with the roads, some areas do not have trees as they used to. For example, now with the Nairobi Expressway, there are less trees in Nairobi. Yeah, so Nairobi is still the city and the green city under the sun. Because thankfully, we have Nairobi National Park, we have the Arboretum, we have City Park, we have Uhuru Park. We have so many green spaces around us, and Karura Forest is not so far away from us. So that still makes it the green city under the sun. And now with Nairobi National Park, it's the only city in the entire world with a national park.
I'm glad that we're mentioning these parks because I think that we need to open up these spaces for more people to go to. So there's Karura where people go for walks on weekends. I like Ngong Forest Sanctuary.
Ngong Road Forest.
Yeah. And there's also another Ngong Forest on the Southern Bypass. So you're right. There are quite a few places which I always hear visitors to Nairobi complimenting the fact that we have different ways of relaxing on a weekend other than just, you know, partying.
Yeah, or malls.
Or malls or the other various ways. Thanks for that reminder. I'm reading your blog, highlighted to me another aspect of maybe why I feel like not so optimistic about where we're headed environmentally. But I'm so glad you're here because you're changing that for me slowly. So I was one of those kids who loved geography as a kid. However, I never considered to go into that kind of career as much as I felt that I loved the environment. It just didn't seem something open to me as a career path. So I read You studied wildlife
management
as a course in University of Nairobi. How did you end up choosing this as your path?
Okay, so most people don't know this, but that was not my first choice. So what happened is, in primary school, I was in the wildlife club. In high school, I was also in the wildlife club. And then now after KCC, I had to make a decision on what I wanted to do. All I knew I wanted to do was work with animals. That's the only thing I wanted. I didn't want to work with people at all. I was like, no, I'm not going to talk to people. I want to be Dr. Doolittle and commune with animals. So my first choice was actually veterinary medicine. And then there was wildlife management in there. And then there was environmental science. But what I didn't like about environmental science was I still had to interact with people. That's the information I knew when I was in high school. That's all I knew. Like, environmental science is more of people and less of wildlife. And it's also more of climate change stuff. So there's always a difference between wildlife management and environmental science. That's one thing.
Okay.
So how I landed into wildlife management is in UON, and it's also in the same department as veterinary science. I'd actually paid for veterinary science.
So you wanted to be a vet?
I wanted to be a vet and just work with animals. Unforeseen circumstances, I just decided to do wildlife because vet was still is a more on the higher side in terms of the school fees and stuff. So I chose wildlife because I was like, I'm still going to be in the wild with wildlife. So I didn't say no to that opportunity. And that's how I landed into wildlife management. But all I knew since a long time ago, but not a really long time, mostly in high school. Because now when I was in primary school, all I wanted to do was be a cardiologist, like all young parents, all parents tell us to do is be doctors and lawyers and engineers.
Okay,
Yeah, so that deviated now when I got into high school and then I met chemistry and I was like, nope, not doing this. So I looked for something else to do and now found I am really into working with animals and all that.
I don't know where that course was hiding when I was speaking.
I think for us, mostly in high school, we had our wildlife teacher, who was also our chemistry teacher and class teacher. He gave us more options. It was like, there's veterinary medicine, there's wildlife management, there's environmental science. And then now when you go, the only university then I wanted to do was to go to was University of Nairobi because they were the best in environmental science and wildlife management and veterinary medicine, especially veterinary medicine. So that's how I landed into knowing other courses. There's also range management. There are so many courses related to environmental issues.
But I think I saw that the course has been discontinued.
It hasn't been discontinued in University of Nairobi, University of Eldoret. I think most of that, where it has been discontinued is, I think, Egerton. It's been discontinued in Egerton, but it's because these, I don't know, in class, for example, us, when I was in uni, in class, we were only 15. Yeah, in undergrad. Our own class was 15. The previous class was 10. The class after me was, they were also 15. And then to top it off, we were only two ladies, and then the rest were men. So 13 men and then two ladies. So it's not that of a popular course, and it's also a very expensive course to run as a university. Not now as a student, as a university, because it has to involve field trips and all that, which sometimes the university finds expensive. So some universities have opted to discontinue it. Also, it's not that popular. So when students are selecting courses, it's not the first thing they will think about.
What are the other choices? You mentioned that it's mostly men who are taking it. So I'm getting an image of it's very
male-dominated.
Male-dominated. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's because of perception or if it's because of just the environment around how we do conservation here.
I'd say it's mostly about perception because I have so many friends, female friends, who will be in the field and someone will be like, we are waiting for the your boss to come, and at that time they are the boss, so it becomes very challenging, and also it involves a lot of work, a lot of dirty work, which I don't think it's more glorified. But on the other side, there are so many female conservationists, female wildlife managers out there who are white, a very white dominated field compared to environmental science. There's always a gap. We always have a fight between my friends who've done environmental science and us who've done wildlife management. Because them, they've had the luxury of the most things they deal with is pollution, climate change. That's their main background. For us, pollution and climate change are like second, because what we deal mostly is human wildlife conflict, habitat loss. Those are the things we mostly deal with. So there's a disparity, but both of us combined can form a really powerful network.
Do you combine often?
I don't know. We do combine often, because at least now we both share the same knowledge. So at the end of the day, protecting biodiversity will reduce climate change far much more than people actually understand. So we do combine our resources, our energies, what we know more than each other. Because currently, if I sit down with someone who did environmental science, they're more knowledgeable on climate change. Especially when you immediately leave undergraduate, they're more knowledgeable. But when you stay more in your field, you get to understand all those concepts more. So for me, compared to someone who's done environmental science, I'm more also knowledgeable about climate change, because it's always a learning process.
It's still part of the role, but it's more experiential maybe than theoretically.
So for I'll go back to into context. For example, when you're doing wildlife management, you're expected to work in parks. So you're expected to be in KWS or work in conservancies. But when you do environmental science, people will think out there that you're supposed to be in NEMA or in... So there's that... I'm now speaking on the outsider view, because now that's what our parents tell us. When you do wildlife management, they ask you, ujapata kazi KWS? When you do environmental science, ujapata kazi NEMA? But at the end of the day, someone who's done environmental science can still work in a park. And for me, I can still work in NEMA, because it's one and the same thing. They know the environmental science are still taught about wildlife management policies, and us, we're still taught about environmental policies. So there's no difference. It's just the context and the curriculum of what it has.
I hope somebody in the universities is listening to this and thinking about how we can get more eyes on the ball of conservation through education, because I don't know how many people live near a park.
So many people. Yes, so many people outside Nairobi. We have, I think, above 40 national parks and reserves in Kenya. And there are so many communities living around national parks or with wildlife.
Actually, you know what? I'm just realizing I should have figured. So those are such interesting numbers. 40 national parks outside of Nairobi.
National parks and reserves.
And reserves. Mm-hmm. So that's all around Kenya. Mm-hmm. And so that means that you have at least 40 areas where you're dealing with that human-wildlife conflict. But it's mostly white dominated as a field. Mm-hmm. Now, why should we have 40 national parks around Kenya, which means that there are as many people living around those areas who I assume are local and Kenyan and with interests in terms of maintaining their environment for the sake, their own sake, really. Mm-hmm. Then why don't we have professionals that are Kenyan leading in these efforts?
We do. I'd say we do have Kenyans who are leading, but the ones who take most of the attention from it is white people. Sorry to say that.
Wow.
Yes. And this is especially in areas like conservancies, which are in Nanyuki, mostly in Nanyuki and like Laikipia region. So conservation, especially as us being people in the conservation space, when someone says conservation, the only thing they see is a white person. They rarely will see a black person or a Kenyan person leading it. But that's because that's how conservation came into Kenya. So it's a concept that was brought into Kenya, yet as our grandparents, our great-grandparents, conservation is something they practiced, but it's not something they were taught. It's something that was in them, and it's the same thing with climate change. Climate change, the word climate change itself is also a concept that was brought, but us as Africans, we know what climate change is, but we didn't have a name for it. We also didn't have a name for conservation. So those are concepts that have been brought, and we have to, like, we are being taught something that we already know. So it's just quite, I don't know what what word to put it, but it's not something that, it's something that has always been in us, mm-hmm. but now other people have come and told us, you should do this, you shouldn't do this, but we've been, what you're saying, telling us not to do, we've been doing it.
Yeah.
So
okay, so as we're speaking, the two key names who I feel are mentionable in terms of the history of how we started thinking about conservation in these areas, Jane Goodall, who I have thoughts about, which are not very positive, all of them. And when you say female white people are mostly the ones in the limelight, then her name comes up top mm-hmm. for me, because she's like the ancestor of all these other ones. And Leakey, who at one point was even at the head of KWS mm-hmm. as a white person, who then we all of us went, okay, so they're dealing with those things. Let us continue with life. But I also feel like, and this is me just putting out my thoughts, culturally we came into a situation where our cultures were put lower than, you know, we are historically colonized. Mm-hmm. It's just sad to see that, you know, after independence, we should have started celebrating our own cultures and saying that, by the way, our cultures, we value this. I remember in Wangari Maathai's book, I think it's Unbowed, mm-hmm. where she narrates her history of how she was born
yeah.
and how life was in her village by the time she was coming to be, and how different it sounds and how attuned to nature it sounds. So much has changed in the perception of how people engage with
wildlife.
With wildlife, mm-hmm. with any kind of animal, really. It's just, those are the kind of things that I was saying that they give me a little bit of a stomach ache, because it's, how is it that we had the wildlife? You know, those people, I'm sorry, when the white people came, the British, they came from a land that had exhausted its own resources. They actually mm-hmm. didn't have wildlife. And that's why it was so surprising for them to come here and to find all this abundance and claim it for themselves. I'm sad that we never reclaimed the narrative that actually, because we lived here, and I think that's why ancestral land is something, I don't know if we'll ever come to passing, mm-hmm. but we need to have those discussions for more than just where people are putting down their house, to say that the reason why this place is important is because the knowledge that came together with living here is quite valuable, and we're losing it. The more people migrate, mm-hmm. I'm not against migration on its own, but I'm against migration that's forced with other motives. Leave people to travel around. Why do we have boundaries?
Yeah.
EU doesn't have those kind mm-hmm. of boundaries that we have here. Anyway, I deviate. Let me come back in course. Who is the face of conservation to you? You have a blog, award-winning blog, I should mention. Mm-hmm. Well done. Congrats. In it, you have written the story about Enzi, who experiences changes in his ecosystem. So what inspired the story, and what would you like to see with that kind of a story of Enzi? And who is Enzi?
So I'll begin by saying Nyikasilika means wild instincts.
Nyikasilika, which is the name of your award-winning blog.
Yes, it means wild instincts.
In which language?
Swahili.
In Swahili?
Yes.
I did not know that.
So how I came up with the name is, I think I wrote a whole story about that on my blog, but I'll keep it short. So in the beginning, it was called Wild Instincts.
In English?
In English.
Okay.
But that was on WordPress.
Okay.
And then I wanted it to be a standalone site, but I didn't want it to go with Wild Instincts, because Wild Instincts would be, I think, difficult to register, because I think everyone can think about that name. So I wanted something unique. So I, my uncle, who passed away last year, was a Swahili writer. And so he had so many Swahili dictionaries, Swahili to English dictionaries, the old ones, not these new ones, like the really, really old ones. So we had to, I looked at the dictionary and checked wild instincts. So I checked wild, I checked instincts. Mm. So wild has other translations in Kiswahili, but I liked nyika. And then instincts now means silika. Now in the old Swahili version. So that's how I came up with Nyika Silika.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks for... it's not Mwitu that's wild anymore.
Yeah. Like now Nyika Silika, it's like the old... I don't know if it's the old Swahili, but it's the beginning, like the old ones, yeah. Like the ones Tanzanians speak. That type of Swahili, not our Kenyan Swahili. Yeah.
We always have a fight. For those who don't know, Kenyan Kiswahili is a bit different to Tanzanian Swahili. But we won't say whose is better, except that Tanzanians is more grammatically correct. Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah.
And now on the story of Enzi. So this was a chance story that one day my son, I think when he was 5 or 4, I can't remember clearly. He told me he had a dream about a crocodile in a river, and then he was on top of the river. So I asked him to narrate that story for me. And then I asked him, so what did the crocodile do? What were you doing on the crocodile's back? And then now he told me, he didn't tell me anything else. So I was like, this seems like an interesting story that I can craft. Mm-hmm. Now he's started something, let me continue it. So now that's how I came up with now the story, which is about Enzi, who's on a top of a crocodile, and they're having conversations with the crocodile of how the river is changing, mm-hmm. and what is happening downstream, what is happening around him. Yeah, so it's just a childlike feeling because you wouldn't expect to be on top of a crocodile. And I think when I publish the book, I should write there, do not try this at home. do not go and start talking to crocodiles. Mm-hmm. So it's just a mythical conversation, and I'm bringing the issue of pollution, mm-hmm. of climate change in a childlike perspective.
And in that childlike perspective, you left the story at a cliffhanger. And I was like, this is a very smart person who is writing. It's not a fairy tale. It's quite something that kids should read and think about. Yeah. I think you leave it at a point of view where somebody's supposed to think about what actually your action is going to be. Mm-hmm. Are you going to contribute to the destruction or to the solution? From your perspective, is climate anxiety one of the themes that you're trying to explore there? Or did I just pick it up for myself because it's a condition that I'm currently facing?
I think it's something, it's like the way you write a book and then someone narrates it differently. Ah. Yes. So it's...
So that's what I took out of it.
Yes, that's what you've taken out of it.
Okay. So for the sake of the audience, I'll ask you, could you describe what climate anxiety is?
I'll try to, because I'm not a psychologist, but I'd say climate anxiety is looking at what is happening on the ground or around you and wondering whether there's a future or will be banned or, and there's no, you're seeing no, you feel like no one is taking action. So it's like you have no hope. That type of feeling. Like if you put anxiety, now put climate anxiety, you really do not have to, you don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow. Like there's no, you don't have hope, you don't have, you just don't have hope, or you don't see the end. You see like no one is taking action and all that.
And some things that can contribute to climate anxiety are things like changing weather patterns, which we're experiencing right now. Like literally it's raining in January. I don't know how or when was the last time it was this rainy in a January in Nairobi, because usually our weather pattern is that this is our hottest month. This mm-hmm. is our summer. We're supposed to be basking yeah. and burning and the grass is drying. And now we're met with rain. So these kind of things that we are experiencing, but we can't change because I can't call the rain to come back. We don't know if we'll get the rains for, you know, the next ones mm-hmm. are supposed to be in April.
In April, yeah.
We don't know if they're gonna come, right? And so what does that mean for our farmers and food? I like food.
So yeah.
That can see where the anxiety is coming from me. Because what are we going to eat if it doesn't rain anymore?
Yeah.
So. But actually, I want to mention that I did come here with a person. Oh, we're going to talk about how the climate is deteriorating. And then you start me up with like, oh, we don't have so many trucks in Nairobi anymore. And I'm like, by the way, you are right. I was one of those people who never realized that. And also in the same vein, I do remember when we were in high school, one of the biggest threats to climate used to be acid rain, the depleting of the ozone layer. And these are things that have been reversed.
Mm-hmm. No, but depleted of the ozone layer is still happening. That's why climate change is continuing to increase. And now going back to Nairobi, Nairobi still, we need more trees in Nairobi because now we have more buildings, we have more roads. So still things, and people have bought more cars.
And we have floodings that I don't remember us having floodings back in the day when I was growing up.
Yeah, but mostly that is because technically Nairobi in itself was a wetland.
Okay.
So even the flooding that occurs, it's something that is like a natural thing. But what has, I'd say that, for example, like Thailand, it's called Singapore, for example. Singapore was built on a wetland, but they don't experience this type of flooding.
Why?
So, because they've built nice drainage systems that prevent that from happening. So now our drainage systems in Kenya, especially in Nairobi, I don't think they're at par. And also the good ones are filled up with plastic bottles or plastic things, so they're blocked. So that also results in flooding. So there are so many things to equate to why we are flooding. One, Nairobi was a wetland in the first place. And also, and you can know it's a wetland because if you look at the river network in Nairobi, it's a lot. There are so many rivers that go through Nairobi. The Nairobi River you see. There are so many rivers that now connect and form Nairobi River. They come all the way from Dandora, from Mathare, from all the way from Ruiru. We have so many. The river network in Nairobi is huge. That's why it was a wetland. Yeah.
But we were hoping that these rivers will dry up so we can live on the...
Why?
I'm assuming, seeing as how we're drowning ourselves, buildings are being built on riparian. I was so shocked to see the return of the shell on Oloitoktok.
Yeah.
I thought we demolished that. I thought we said that it's not supposed to be there and then it's back.
Mm-hmm.
Another topic on your blog also is about logging. How contradictory it is to plant trees as well as advocate for chopping trees, and like, where do we stand in our resolution to, you know, combat this climate change? But is it combatable? Is it something that we should combat, or is climate change something that's just natural to life? Nothing stays the same. So why should we expect the climate to stay the same? Like, what are your thoughts on that? Is it something that we should maintain a worry of, or should we just accept that things are going to change and then continue?
In terms of climate change is always happening. But the climate change that is happening in this century or the previous century and the next centuries is a result of anthropogenic activities. So when we say anthropogenic activities, that's human activities. So human activities is industries, it's commerce, it's the buildings, it's the roads that are increasing more. And then we are forgetting about nature. So we are not doing sustainable development, like what sustainable development, which is another topic we'll discuss later because I also don't like that word. But we are not building with nature in mind, and we are also so very, very, very greedy. So climate change is just happening. And also, for example, like the oil, the petroleum manufacturing industry, the oil and gas industry. the key thing is they need to stop, for example, drilling more wells, because we already have enough oil and gas drills.
Do we?
Yes, we do.
But
we keep building.
The price of fuel is going up. It's running out.
It's not running out. It's there in plenty. But that's also another greed and business aspect. That's a whole other topic that needs to be discussed on its own, and especially with professionals. So they're already enough. So, for example, last year we had COP28. So COP28 is the Conference of Parties on Climate Change. And one of the key things, it was held in Dubai. Dubai is a oil and gas industry. Yes.
Right.
Which was also contradictory.
It's true. Continue.
Yeah, so the main thing was for such countries or such states to stop drilling more, because there's already enough. So there's that oil that is in those, it can sustain generations and generations. And we also have the advantage of we have green energy, we have wind, we have solar, we have hydrogen, we have so much that is going on green energy. So instead of putting so much focus on the oil and gas industry, the same focus we put on developing mechanisms or just advancing the oil and gas industry, we should also put the same in advancing the green energy sector. Because we have an abundance of that, more than we even, that's even continuous, that will never end, the oil and gas will end.
Wow.
But we will always have the sun, the wind. We'll always have water if we protect our forests. That's where now we need to talk more on green energy. And yeah.
I won't say I don't like the word sustainability. I love the mentality of sustainability. But I feel like it's being co-opted and commercialized with things like carbon credits. I really a disliker. I really dislike the whole carbon credits movement. What are your thoughts?
On carbon credits, I'd say it's a good thing, but also it's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very bad thing because, for example, not as in bad in terms of helping other people, I'd say bad in it's so greed-wise, like it has a lot of greed in it. It has a lot of only few people benefit from it. You know, it's not like something that a community will benefit from it. Or even if they benefit from it, they'll be given the little of the carbon credits. So that's how I'll put it. Like, I'm not against carbon credits, but the way it's being brought out right now, it's filled with so much greed. It's filled with only a few people will benefit and such like things. It's not inclusive. I don't think it's very inclusive as it should be.
And I'm Googling here what carbon credits actually are so that I can just include the listener on that. So carbon credits, according to Google, they are transparent and measurable results-based ways for companies to support activities such as protecting and restoring irrevocable natural carbon sinks like forests or marine ecosystems and scaling nascent carbon removal technology that can keep global climate goals within reach. So carbon credits are like bonga points for the atmosphere.
Yeah.
I think every country was given a certain amount of credits, and then according to how much you're contributing to emissions, you get deducted these credits. And technically, in my layman understanding of carbon credits, is that it should bring a little bit of fairness where developing countries such as our own that really don't contribute as much towards the
climate
problem
change.
Of climate change emissions as the developed countries do, then it's sort of a place where we get to have an advantage to them. But now where we have a problem is where they get used as currency.
Yeah.
Right?
So like, I'd say carbon credits for me is we are telling you to pollute and to do all the emissions. And then you're telling us who have all these natural resources to not do anything. Like, don't develop, just keep your forests. Yet we want to develop. Like, we can develop with our forests. I believe there's a world where we can develop and be a first world, as it's been called, and we still have all our natural resources.
There's no such thing as a first world. Let me just put it out there. We don't have first world.
Yeah.
So, but I agree. Yeah. I agree. So that's exactly the catch, is that we now get petitioned or lobbied to sell some of our credits to the people who say, oh, you know, we have these industries already, so we need more credits to continue developing. Mm-hmm. But we don't look at the fact that, okay, when we sell them, what do we leave for ourselves, mm-hmm. for our own advancement, number one. And number two...
So what happens technically is, you see, like a polluting country like Dubai, for example, since they're the oil and gas industry, they have an oil and gas industry and they have a high emission, they are supposed to give now the credits to countries in Africa or South America or Asia.
Ah, so they're supposed to give them to us when they use them.
Now they're supposed, it's like a funding thing. So it's, for example, if they emit this amount of pollution or emission, mm-hmm. so us who have the forests that absorb all the carbon dioxide are supposed to be paid for keeping up forests.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And then now they're supposed to pay us in terms of for us to now plant more trees, or technically it's not just planting more trees. It's even like it's supposed to go towards sustainable development and stuff. But that's a whole other topic.
Okay, yeah, I think that deserves its own episode. But I think what we both are agreeing on is the fact that it kind of is creating another avenue for us to be the absorbers of the shocks of the system, which is sad. And I hope those people who are in the places of power that be can be able to give us a little bit more capabilities of using the credits more to the advantage of our mm-hmm. future generations, right? Okay, cool. So to wrap it up, I just really don't want to go without talking about biophilic conversations, because I think it's very important. You're including the youth into the conversation of conservation. Tell us a little bit about that and who can engage and where they can engage.
So biophilic conversations came about when I wanted a platform where young people could have a voice and just an open platform. So what biophilic conversations, what we do is we are focused towards involving the youth in conservation and climate action. So that involves capacity building, environmental awareness. And currently we have a platform called Working for Nature, where now we highlight, like the way you were saying, people don't know the difference between environmental science and, or even if wildlife management exists.
Yes.
So that's our main purpose. We go to high schools, we show them about, we teach them or educate them about the opportunities out there or the courses out there they can do in relation to environmental issues. So basically how you can reach us is biophilic.ke. Throughout our social medias. That's who we are.
What's the age group?
Age group is from high school to adults. We don't have...
big children like me?
Yes.
Okay, good. So biophilic KE.
Biophilic KE on all platforms. So what we do also is we are engaged in policy. So we are involved in like policy amendments and all that. So yeah, and also educating young people about policies. Yeah, including carbon credits.
Yes, and I think it's a very good place to rest some of my anxiety, you know. Part of anxiety is not feeling like you have something to do. So for anybody who's out there listening and feeling like I am interested in conservation, I'm interested in environment, I'm interested in seeing it being better, more than telling the people in the matatu to stop throwing things outside of the window, which I don't know why Kenyans, we have this habit. It's very bad. Please stop littering in the street. Just the most basic thing you can start with is just watch where your garbage goes. Number one. And you'll see such a change, even in your immediate environment. Mm-hmm. But further to that, if you want to explore a bit more, please do engage with Nyika Silika and Biophilic Conversations. Their information will also be in the description. And thank you so much. I'm so honored that, you know, somebody said, when you have a podcast, you're literally asking strangers to come and spend time with you. So thank you so much for coming to spend time with a stranger on this happy new year of 2024, January.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, and come again soon.
Yes.
That's it for today's episode. And I am your host, Triza, and producer of the Tulizane podcast. For this conversation, we had Vicky, who is our wildlife and conservationist, and her details are in the bio. I really liked that we had this conversation to begin the year with. I think some of us have resolutions, and if your resolution doesn't include something sustainable to do with your environment, then here is your reminder to include it. Find Vicky on her pages as mentioned, and we will see you next episode. Subscribe!